Welcome to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring the random prompts of Daniel Rosehill as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters. Join us for deep dives into AI, technology, and whatever other random thing Daniel finds fascinating today. Subscribe on Spotify or your favorite podcatcher. Now, today's episode.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hi, Herman and Quirin. So I recently installed a GPS tracker in our car, which is something I'd been wanting to do for years. My wife and I don't have a fixed car parking spot, so we have to park on the street. And I guess there's two reasons it seemed like a good idea. One is sometimes you do forget where you parked if you're not driving that frequently. And the second thing is from a security standpoint, I guess it seemed like a good idea to have some way to know if your car, you know, has been robbed or whatever, it's going to leave its geolocation. And all these tracking tools are quite affordable. They require 4G, but one of the good things, one of the most best value for money things in Israel is actually cell phone plans. So for 12 shekels a month, which is about $3, I was able to get a data card for IoT. Which gives you like 1 or 2 gigabits per month and covers your needs. So it's quite, between that and the tracker, for about $50 all in, I was able to get that set up, and it seems like a good investment. So the one that I went for was using the OBD2 port. We have a Seat Ibiza, as I mentioned, and that's on the far left. It's this big conspicuous port. There's other ways to wire it in if you know a bit more about car electronics, but this was really my first time even opening up the fuse box to put it in. The concern, I guess, is there being a parasitic draw. But we have, it was a good project, but we've looked for a while at, we need to upgrade. The tablet on our car is really underpowered. It's like 1 gigabyte of RAM, and it's gone so slow that we can't even use it for directions. And a dash cam. So all these things in general, you know, my approach to cars would be taking things to the garage. But recently, with building the computer, that was a lot of fun and quite a fulfilling feeling in a project. So Herman and Quirin, my question is this: for stuff involving car electronics, when I was looking, opening up the back of the tablet to see what were the inputs going into it, thinking that, you know, if I can see there's 3 wires, take a few photos and ask an AI tool what are these connections, it might be fairly straightforward. But it was actually this whole mess of wires, and I don't know if it was poor cable management on the part of the garage or just the car, or it's really very complicated. So Herman and Quirin, I've never really touched car mechanics. I'm a computer guy, but computers, desktop computers, look extremely intimidating as well at first, but once you learn the components, they're not so hard. What are your thoughts about getting into car? Is it feasible for someone to swap out a tablet in their own car, or do what might have been a better installation for this GPS tracker, wiring it into the proper fuse connectors instead of using the OBD2? Is it something that is very risky? I guess I've been very hesitant to do it with a car because I would have assumed that, you know, tampering with electronics, you don't want to take any chances. We're definitely not looking to do this to save money on a garage visit. I think it would be the ultimate false economy. But if it's safe and something that your average person can actually look up, where do you get started, Herman and Quirin? And do you think I could actually install a new tablet in this car? Over to you two.
Hey everyone, welcome back to My Weird Prompts. I am Quirin, and I am sitting here in our living room in Jerusalem with my brother, the man who probably has a multimeter permanently attached to his belt loop at this point.
Herman Poppleberry, at your service. And you are not entirely wrong about the multimeter, Quirin. It is a vital tool for a civilized life. We have a really interesting prompt today from our housemate Daniel. He has been busy tinkering with his car lately, and he is looking to level up his DIY electronics game.
Yeah, Daniel was telling me about this. He managed to get a GPS tracker running through the OBD2 port, which is the onboard diagnostics port for those who might not know. But now he is looking at the fuse box, and even thinking about swapping out the whole head unit because his current tablet is, well, it is a bit of a potato with only 1 gigabyte of random access memory.
It is a classic progression, right? You start with a plug-and-play solution, you see that it works, and suddenly you are looking at the wiring harness wondering how far the rabbit hole goes. Daniel has experience building computers, which is a great foundation, but car electronics are a whole different beast in some very specific ways. In 2026, even a basic C2Bisa is essentially a rolling local area network.
That is exactly what I wanted to dig into today. Because on the surface, a computer and a car both use electricity. They both have data buses, and they both have components that need to talk to each other. But if you are coming from the world of desktop PCs, what are the big aha moments or the oh no moments that you need to be ready for when you step into the garage?
The first big realization is that a car is a much more hostile environment than a desk. Think about a PC. It sits in a climate-controlled room, hopefully on a stable surface, and it gets a very clean, regulated stream of power from a power supply unit. A car. A car is a vibrating metal box that swings from freezing temperatures at night to sweltering heat in the sun. And the power? The 12-volt system in a car is anything but stable. When you crank the engine, the voltage can drop to 9 or 10 volts, and when the alternator is charging, it can spike up to 14.8 volts.
Right, so the clean power we take for granted in a PC is a luxury in the automotive world. Daniel mentioned he is currently using the OBD2 port for his GPS tracker. For the listeners, that is the port usually under the dashboard that mechanics use to read error codes. It provides constant power, which is why it is great for a tracker. But Daniel mentioned a concern about parasitic draw. How real is that danger?
It is very real, especially if the car sits for a few days. The OBD2 port usually has a constant 12-volt pin that stays live even when the ignition is off. A small GPS tracker might only pull 30 or 40 milliamps, which sounds like nothing, but over a week, that can absolutely drain a battery to the point where the car won't start. Most modern trackers have a sleep mode where they only wake up if the accelerometer detects movement. But if you are DIYing a solution with something like a Raspberry Pi or an Arduino, you have to be really careful about your power management.
So that leads us to his next step, which is wiring into the fuse box. He wants to move away from the conspicuous port and hide the wiring. If he is looking at the fuse box, what is the safest way for a beginner to tap into that power? I have seen people literally just wrap a wire around a fuse leg and jam it back in, which feels... well, it feels like a fire hazard to me.
Oh, please, never do the wrap and jam. That is a recipe for a bad day. The gold standard for DIY car electronics is something called an add-a-circuit or a fuse tap. It is a little device that plugs into an existing fuse slot. It has two fuse slots of its own, one for the original circuit you just borrowed the spot from, and one for your new accessory. It gives you a clean fused power lead without cutting or splicing any of the factory wiring. For a C2Bisa, he will likely need the mini or micro 2 size fuse taps.
That sounds much more like the modularity of a PC. But how does he know which fuse to pick? Because you don't want to tap into something critical like the airbags or the engine control unit, right?
Exactly. You want to look for what we call non-critical or comfort circuits. Things like the cigarette lighter, the rear wiper, or even the heated seats if the car has them. But more importantly, Daniel needs to decide if he wants switched power or constant power. If he wants the tracker to be able to find the car after it has been stolen, he needs constant power. If he is installing something like a dash cam that only needs to run while he is driving, he wants switched power, which only turns on when the key is in the ignition. You find this out using a multimeter. You ground one probe to the car's metal frame and touch the other to the little metal test points on top of the fuses while the car is off. If it shows 12 volts, it is constant. If it shows 0, turn the key. If it then shows 12, it is switched.
Okay, that makes sense. It is a bit of detective work before you even start the installation. But let's talk about the bigger project Daniel mentioned, the tablet upgrade. He has a C2Bisa, and the current head unit is sluggish. 1 gigabyte of random access memory is definitely not enough for modern navigation apps, or even a smooth music interface in 2026. He mentioned looking at the back of the tablet and seeing a mess of wires. As a computer guy, that has to be intimidating. In a PC, everything is color-coded and keyed so you can't plug it in backward. Is the car world that organized?
Not even close, Korn. Well, it depends. If you buy a high-quality aftermarket head unit from a reputable brand, they usually sell a vehicle-specific wiring harness. This is the secret sauce for DIYers. For a seat, it is usually a quad-lock connector. It has a plug on one end that matches your car's factory connector and a plug on the other that matches the new radio. You connect the two, and suddenly that mess of wires becomes a single beautiful bridge. But if Daniel is looking at a generic Android tablet meant for a car, he might have to do some manual wiring. That is where the computer building skills really come into play. You have to be comfortable reading a pinout diagram.
And that is where I think the fear comes in. If I plug a central processing unit into a motherboard wrong, the pins might bend. If I wire a car radio wrong, could I theoretically set the car on fire or blow up the computer that runs the engine?
You could definitely blow a lot of fuses. Setting the car on fire is less likely if you are using proper fuses, but it is not impossible if you have a dead short to ground without a fuse in the way. But the real danger in modern cars like a Seat Ibiza is the CAN bus. That stands for Controller Area Network. It is basically the car's internal internet. The radio, the dashboard, the engine, the doors, they all talk to each other on these two wires. If you accidentally send 12 volts down a CAN bus wire because you thought it was a power lead, you could fry every control module in the car. That is a multi-$1,000 mistake.
Okay, so step one, don't fry the CAN bus. That sounds like a good rule for life. How does a DIYer avoid that? Is it just a matter of being meticulous with the diagrams?
Meticulous is the word. You never, ever guess. You find the factory service manual or a highly trusted forum post for your specific year and model. For a Seat Ibiza, there are huge communities of enthusiasts who have documented every single wire, and you use your multimeter to verify everything before you make a permanent connection. If the diagram says thin orange and green wire is the CAN high signal, you don't just trust it, you check the voltage. Data lines usually sit at around 2.5 volts and flicker slightly. Power lines are 12. If you see 12 volts on a wire that is supposed to be data, stop everything.
It sounds like the measure twice, cut once rule applies here, but it is test twice, crimp once. Speaking of crimping, what is your take on the actual physical connections? In a PC, we have these nice plastic headers. In a car, people use electrical tape, wire nuts, soldering. What is the pro way to do it? So it doesn't vibrate loose after 6 months of driving on Jerusalem's bumpy streets?
Avoid wire nuts at all costs. Those are for houses, not things that move. Electrical tape is okay for a temporary fix, but it gets gooey and peels off in the heat. Soldering is a point of debate. Some people love it, but in high vibration environments, solder can actually make the wire brittle and prone to snapping right at the edge of the solder joint. The industry standard for car electronics is actually high-quality crimp connectors. Specifically, heat shrink butt connectors. You slide the wires in, crimp them with a proper tool, and then use a heat gun to shrink the tubing. It creates a waterproof, vibration-resistant, and electrically solid connection. It is very satisfying to do.
I can see you getting excited about the crimping, Herman. Let's go back to the tablet itself. Daniel mentioned his current one has 1 gigabyte of RAM. If he replaces it, he is probably looking at these Android head units you see all over the internet. They look like tablets, they run Android, and they fit in the dash. But I have heard mixed things about them. Are they actually a good upgrade, or is he just trading one set of problems for another?
It is a bit of a Wild West market. You can buy a very cheap unit for $100 that will be just as slow as his current one and might have a screen you can't see in the sunlight. But if you spend a bit more, say $400, you can get a unit with 8 or even 12 gigabytes of random access memory and a modern processor like the UIS7862S. Those things are fantastic. They support wireless Apple CarPlay and Android Auto, which is really what most people want anyway. The secret is to look for units that have a dedicated digital signal processor for better audio quality and a CAN bus decoder box included.
A CAN bus decoder? What does that do? Is that how you keep the steering wheel buttons working?
Exactly. Without that decoder, your car and your new radio are speaking different languages. The decoder listens to the car's network and tells the radio, "Hey, the driver just pressed the volume up button," or "The driver just put the car in reverse, turn on the backup camera." For a set of Ibiza, which is part of the Volkswagen group, these decoders are very common and usually work quite well. They can even show you your climate control settings or your tire pressure right on the new screen.
That is actually really cool. It makes the car feel much newer than it is. But let's talk about the safety aspect Daniel asked about. He is worried about tampering with electronics. Beyond the risk of frying a module, is there a risk to the car's actual safety systems? Could a poorly installed radio trigger an airbag or interfere with the brakes?
Interfering with the brakes is extremely unlikely. Those systems are designed to be fail-safe and are usually on a very isolated part of the network. Airbags, however, are something to be respected. In many seat models, the passenger airbag warning light is actually integrated into the trim around the radio. If you unplug that light and turn on the ignition to test your new radio, the car will see that the airbag status light is missing and throw a permanent airbag error code. You often can't clear that code without a specialized tool like a VCDS or a trip to the mechanic. So, the golden rule of car electronics, always, always disconnect the negative terminal of your battery before you start unplugging things.
That seems like a very simple precaution that saves a lot of headaches. Disconnect the battery, wait a few minutes for the capacitors to discharge, and then start your work. It is like turning off the power supply on your PC before you swap the graphics card.
Exactly. And just like building a PC, take pictures. Take a picture of every connector before you unplug it. Take a picture of where the screws went. Daniel mentioned the mess of wires behind the tablet. If he takes a clear photo of that and uses an artificial intelligence tool to help label the wires, that is a great use of technology. But he should also look for labels on the wires themselves. Most good aftermarket harnesses have the function printed right on the insulation, like rear left speaker positive, or illumination trigger.
Illumination trigger. I assume that is the wire that tells the radio to dim the screen when you turn on your headlights.
Spot on, Korn. You are becoming a car guy. It is these little details that make a professional feeling installation. If you miss the illumination wire, your screen will be blindingly bright at night. If you miss the parking brake wire, the radio might refuse to let you enter a destination because it thinks you are driving. There are ways to bypass that, of course, but for a first-timer, just following the wiring diagram is the best path.
So, looking at the big picture for Daniel, he has built computers so he knows how to handle delicate components and follow a build guide. He is already comfortable with the OBD2 port, moving to the fuse box and then a full head unit swap. Is this feasible for a weekend project? Or is he going to end up with a car that won't start and a dashboard that is half disassembled?
It is absolutely feasible, but he needs to budget his time. A head unit swap for a beginner isn't a 2-hour job. It is a Saturday morning until Sunday afternoon job. You spend Saturday morning carefully taking the dash apart without breaking the plastic clips. You spend the afternoon doing your wiring and testing it on the bench or loosely connected in the car. Then you spend Sunday morning tidying up the cables, rattle-proofing everything with foam tape, and putting the dash back together. The biggest mistake people make is trying to rush the putting it back together part and ending up with a dashboard that squeaks every time they hit a bump.
Oh, the dashboard squeak is the worst. It is the coil whine of the automotive world. You mentioned breaking plastic clips. That feels like something a PC builder wouldn't be used to. In a PC, everything is held by standardized screws. In a car, it is often hidden plastic tabs that feel like they are going to snap if you pull too hard.
And sometimes they do. The secret weapon here is a plastic trim removal toolkit. They are cheap, maybe $15, and they are made of soft nylon. They allow you to pry the dashboard panels off without scratching the finish. If you use a flathead screwdriver, you will regret it. The other secret is TESA tape. It is a fuzzy fabric tape that car manufacturers use to wrap wire looms. If you wrap your new wiring in TESA tape, it won't clatter against the plastic inside the dash. It makes the whole project feel factory.
This is all great practical advice. I want to shift gears slightly and talk about the why of this. Daniel mentioned he wanted a GPS tracker for security because they park on the street in Jerusalem. We have talked about the Internet of Things a lot on this show. Putting a car on the Internet yourself feels very My Weird Prompts. But what about the privacy side? If Daniel is installing a third-party tracker or a cheap Android head unit, where is that data going?
That is the million-dollar question. A lot of these cheap trackers and head units use cloud servers based in countries with very different privacy laws than we have here. You are essentially giving a third party the real-time location of your car. If Daniel is privacy conscious, he should look for trackers that allow you to use your own SIM card and point the data to a server he controls or a reputable open source platform like Trackr.
Trackr? I haven't heard of that one.
It is an amazing open source GPS tracking platform. You can run it on a home server or a small cloud instance. Most of these cheap trackers use a standard protocol that Trackr understands. So instead of the tracker sending your location to a random cloud service, it sends it to your own server. You get the map, the history, and the alerts, but you own the data. It is the ultimate power user move for car tracking.
That sounds like a perfect project for someone who likes building computers and tinkering with software. It bridges the gap between the car and the home server. Now, what about the tablet side of that privacy equation? If he installs a generic Android head unit and logs into his Google account, is that any different than using an Android phone?
It is slightly different because those head units often run a very modified version of Android. They might have pre-installed apps that have broad permissions. My advice for anyone using an Android head unit is to use a burner Google account. Don't log in with your primary email that has your bank details. Create an account specifically for the car. Give it access to your Spotify or whatever you need, but keep it isolated. And if the head unit asks for permission to access your contacts or call logs, think twice before saying yes.
That is solid advice for any smart device, really. Keep it on a need-to-know basis. So, we have covered the fuse box, we have covered the head unit, the CAN bus, the privacy. What is the starting line for someone like Daniel? If he wakes up tomorrow and says, "Today is the day," what is the very first thing he should do?
The very first thing is to go to a website like Crutchfield. Even if he doesn't buy from them, they have an incredible database where you put in your car's make, model, and year, and they tell you exactly what fits and what wiring harnesses you need. After that, join a forum. For a Seat Ibiza, there are places like SCN or Seat CupraNet. Search for head unit upgrade and read the threads where people have already made the mistakes so you don't have to.
I love that. Learn from the mistakes of others. It is much cheaper than learning from your own. And I think the PC building background Daniel has is actually a huge advantage because it means he isn't afraid of a circuit board or a bundle of wires. He just needs to respect the car part of the equation, the vibration, the heat, and the fact that this computer he is working on also happens to travel at 100 kilometers per hour on the highway.
Exactly. It is about a change in mindset. A PC is a static system. A car is a dynamic system. Everything you do needs to be secured, fused, and insulated. If you follow those three rules, secure it so it doesn't move, fuse it so it doesn't burn, and insulate it so it doesn't short, you are ahead of 90% of the people doing DIY car work.
Well, I feel a lot better about Daniel's car now. I was worried I would come home to a pile of smoldering plastic in the driveway, but it sounds like with the right tools and a bit of patience, he can actually turn that Seat Ibiza into something quite high-tech.
I think he can, and honestly, it is such a rewarding project. The first time you put the car in reverse and that big, clear screen shows you the backup camera, or you see your car's location pop up on your own private server, it is a great feeling of, I built this. It is why we do what we do, right?
Absolutely. It is that mastery over the machine feeling. Before we wrap up, I just want to say to everyone listening, if you are tackling a weird project like this, or if you have a question that is burning a hole in your brain, send it our way. We love diving into the weeds on this stuff. And if you have been enjoying the show, we would really appreciate a quick review on your podcast app or on Spotify. It genuinely helps other people find us and keeps the show growing.
It really does. We see every review and it means a lot to us. We have been doing this for over 600 episodes now, and it is the community that keeps us curious.
632, to be exact. We've come a long way from that first episode about smart light bulbs. Anyway, you can find us on Spotify and at our website, myweirdprompts.com. We have the full archive there if you want to see what else we have been up to.
Thanks to Daniel for the prompt and for giving me an excuse to talk about crimp connectors for 20 minutes. It was a good day.
It was a great day. Good luck with the car, Daniel. We will see you all next time on My Weird Prompts.
Bye, everyone. Goodbye. Goodbye.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox Turbo.
Thanks for listening to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring Daniel Rosehill's AI prompts, as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters including me, Cornelius the Sloth. Subscribe on Spotify or visit myweirdprompts.com.